From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Bad Taste, in celebration of the 25th anniversary of Pink Flamingos, the film has been re-released. The plot is about the competition for the title The Filthiest Person Alive. The leading lady was Divine, a 300-pound man. We'll feature an interview with Divine, who died in 1988, and we'll hear from the director of the film, John Waters. Then we go from Bad Taste to Tasting Good. Stanley Tucci discusses directing and starring in Big Night, his homage to Italian food. It just came out on video. And the film debut of a new Canadian director, John Powers, reviews Kissed. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. While people in the Northern Plains fight back floodwaters, the Mississippi River is on a slow, steady rise in the Midwest. The river is expected to crest this weekend, several feet above flood stage. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports from Des Moines.
People have piled 25,000 sandbags along the Mississippi River in Davenport, Iowa. The makeshift levee stands 5 feet tall and has been erected to keep water out of the minor league baseball park on the riverfront. Most people in Davenport don't fear the devastation this year that record flooding in 1993 caused. City officials say that's due in large part to hundreds of volunteers bracing for flooding before it causes a drastic situation. Still, parts of the city's main street have been closed as people anticipate a slow, gradual crest this weekend, which officials say could drag on for the better part of a week. Snowmelt to the north is contributing to the flooding on rivers and streams in the Midwest. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Charges of influence trading against the Israeli prime minister are troubling members of his governing coalition. The leader of Israel's Third Way party says the charges have damaged the Israeli government and that Benjamin Netanyahu may have to resign. Netanyahu still has strong support from rightist politicians and insists he will remain in office. Two explosions today at British railway stations have disrupted British rail traffic. No one has claimed responsibility for the blasts, but the Irish Republican Army is suspected. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The northern part of England is the target of the IRA's disruption campaign. Police closed down four railroad stations and a section of highway after receiving telephone bomb warnings. The callers used an IRA code word. A small bomb went off at the main railroad station in Leeds and also in Doncaster. The IRA campaign seems to be aimed at disrupting the UK's upcoming election. Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, is fielding candidates for that election. Today, British Prime Minister John Major urged the people of Northern Ireland not to vote for them.
They should recognise that a vote in this general election for Sinn Féin is a vote for the IRA.
Nevertheless, Sinn Féin is expected to win several parliamentary seats in the election. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
There are worries about increased terrorism in Italy now that relations are somewhat strained between Iran and Western Europe. Italian reports say Islamic terrorists could target airports and even Pope John Paul. The reports cite a warning issued last night at a meeting of Italy's intelligence and security agencies. The tension rose when a German court blamed Iran for some political assassinations in Berlin. The Vatican and Italy's interior ministry say no extra security measures are in place, but news accounts say authorities at Rome's international airport are on high alert. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 28 points at 6686. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stocks are higher in heavy trading today. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The market is benefiting from optimism about strong corporate earnings after industry leader Microsoft reported record quarterly profit. Microsoft is the most active issue, trading higher by 6%. Tobacco shares are also advancing. Investors are speculating that if a settlement is reached regarding smoking-related health care costs, the chances become greater that these companies would then spin off non-tobacco operations. A merger in the mobile communications industry is being met with favorable reaction. AirTouch Communications is paying $5 billion for the wireless unit of U.S. West Media Group. I'm Doug Krisner.
Chrysler has halted production of its Dodge Viper cars because of a week-old strike at a Detroit engine plant. Another Detroit plant that makes the car had run out of V8 engines. 10 plants have been forced to close so far because of the work stoppage. More than 13,000 workers are idle. The plans involved produce most of Chrysler's Ram and Dakota pickups and all of its Ram vans and Jeep Grand Cherokees. Negotiations continue between the company and the United Auto Workers. The National Hurricane Center will keep some of the funding that it was going to lose. The Commerce Department says it will restore some planned budget cuts at the Hurricane Center in Miami and three other weather centers. The decision saves 11 jobs and restores $715,000 in spending. Many supporters of the weather centers complained that the cuts would cripple warning systems during the Atlantic hurricane season. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average are up more than 28 points at 6,686. Trading is active. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Pink Flamingos opened 25 years ago, it was billed as an exercise in bad taste. Times have changed, but Pink Flamingos hasn't gotten any more tasteful. Too depraved for the regular movie crowd, this campy comedy became a midnight movie phenomenon in the 70s. The film has been re-released in celebration of its anniversary. On this archive edition, we have a 1985 interview with the film's director, John Waters. His other movies include Polyester, which brought back Tab Hunter, Hairspray, which gave Ricky Lake her start, Crybaby, the first film to take Johnny Depp seriously, and Serial Mom, which co-starred Patty Hearst. Pink Flamingos is about two families vying for the title of the filthiest people alive. Pink Flamingos starred two of Waters' regulars. Divine, a 300-pound man, played the leading lady, as he did in several of Waters' films. And the late Edie Massey played the nearly toothless egg lady, a lady obsessed with eggs.
It's 10:30. Babs, Babs, why isn't the egg man here? I'm starving to death for some eggs. Please, Babs, come in and give me some eggs.
I'm coming, Mama, I'm coming. You can hold on.
Cotton, Cotton, Babs won't give me my eggs. Cotton, please come in here and give me my eggs.
Be here in a minute, Edie. Don't you worry. I'll fire you up some, honey.
Eggs! Eggs! Eggs!
John Waters always liked exploitation films. When I spoke with him in 1985, he told me some of his favorites.
Well, I liked the Russ Meyer films very much in the beginning, the Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. I like things that were obscure ones like Door-to-Door Maniac, which starred Johnny Cash, Kitten with a Whip with Anne Margaret. A lot of the big directors today started out with exploitation films. That is the easiest way to start because I always advise film students, whatever you do, don't make a personal little arty film as your first film because it will never get shown and you'll spend all your money and you won't get any of it back. If you want to get in the film business, do something that will end up in a theater, which is an exploitation film. It's the easiest and smartest way to start out. A funny one, though. I mean, I think there's nothing against that.
Is that one of the reasons why you broke so many taboos in your movies to get attention?
Sure. When you have $10,000, $5,000 to make a feature-length movie, you have to do something that the Hollywood studios will not or could not do. And that's what we did. You have to go way out on a limb because you've got to get people's attention, even if they hate it.
The film that first got you a lot of national attention was Pink Flamingos.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the idea for that, of making a movie about two families?
I was driving across the country with David Lockery, and I kept seeing trailer parks. And that's how it came to me. I thought, what's it like to live in a trailer park? And they had Pink Flamingos in front of them. And we all at that time loved that kind of 50s kind of, and it wasn't the look then, certainly. And we liked that kind of Jane Mansfield, all that kind of stuff. So that's how the idea came, just like the filthiest person alive. You know, I don't remember where that came from. I knew that it was a war between two groups of people, and it just sort of happened from that, from seeing these trailer parks.
That and most of your early movies were shot on location, either in an abandoned area
yeah.
or on the streets. Did you ever get hassled by...
Other
yes. residents of the city or
we were arrested,
for
all of us, for conspiracy to commit indecent exposure while we were making Mondo Trasho. And the whole thing was ridiculous. Divine escaped in a two-piece gold lamé outfit driving a 59 red Eldorado convertible, which doesn't say much for the police. They couldn't find Divine. We all got arrested. We had a trial. We got off. The Civil Liberties Union handled it. And the judge read us a poem when he let us off, "Go behind the door and sin no more." I mean, it was absolutely crazy.
You were recently admitted into the Ultimate Art House, which is the art museum. The Baltimore Museum of Art gave a retrospective of your movies. It must have been really controversial in Baltimore to have your movies, which are considered the ultimate in sleaze,
the scary thing. It was not that controversial. It came out, they had Grandma Moses before me. And it was a three-day retrospective. I had a black tie opening. There was editorials in the paper saying how wonderful I was for the city. And I thought, wow, these are the same movies I was afraid of getting arrested of 10 years ago. I just think people change. And if you stick around long enough, they can't get rid of you, then they'll honor you.
Let me read what the Baltimore Museum of Art put in its program to caution its patrons about what they were about to see if they chose to actually attend the screenings of your movies. It said, for filmgoers unfamiliar with the films of John Waters, it should be reported that some critics have described his work as sick, vile, stupid, and repulsive, among their kinder adjectives. Waters himself has assigned his earlier films a self-imposed X rating. The museum and the film forum wish to advise their audience to take the self-imposed X rating seriously before deciding to attend. Do you think that scared away people or got more viewers?
No, I think that what it did, I mentioned that. I said, don't you think you should at least, put something in. I mean, suppose somebody comes that has no idea what it is, that's a museum member, and thinks it's a film about birds in Florida. And I think it served two purposes. One, it was a hype. It definitely was a gimmick, like you're not admitted till after the show starts. And secondly, for the few people that were undecided that their sensibilities might be flayed so much, So I think it didn't bother me at all, I mean, they asked me if I'd mind. I said, no, I thought maybe you should have done it in the first place. So it was really, received very well in Baltimore. The only person that came out and griped about it was the censor lady that used to hassle me for years that has been fired. She's no longer a censor board. And she came through with flying colors. She said she couldn't believe a municipal museum was using tax money for this and stuff. And then she said that I was responsible for every rape and mugging in Baltimore, which I guess was fair enough. But then she said that I was responsible for the dead rats in her cellar. And the reporter said, you don't mean that. She said, yes. Which I thought was I couldn't have written a better line myself.
Who is the censor lady?
Her name is Mary Avera. Maryland was the only state in the country that still had a censor board. And every film that showed Maryland, she had to watch. And she could cut stuff. And she gave me hell for years. I mean, I had big arguments with her every time. She hated movies. She knew nothing about movies. And she would sit there and yell things like, rear entry, in her microphone. I think, rear entry? I mean, I've never even heard that term. And, and she said to me when she cut Pink Flamingo, she cut out sex but left in the end, which I found was a very odd community standard.
What do you think of the way films are censored? What's the procedure, first of all, when you submit a film for censorship?
Well, there is nowhere anymore we have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be you gave her the film, and she sat there and watched it, and she would say, I don't want this, I don't want this. And if you didn't agree with her, you took her to court, which I did, and it was easy to win.
Does it strike you as strange that people who are responsible for censoring films like that get to see more of them than anybody else?
Well, the thing that's the most ridiculous is they helped me. She was my best press agent. If you really want to stop a film, you don't mention it. You don't pay it any attention. When anytime they have pickets outside of a theater, that increases the box office, and you'd think that they would have figured that out by now. Tell people not to see something, and they'll pay any amount to see it.
You've been working in the prisons lately.
Yeah.
As a teacher, really.
It basically grew out of my fascination with going to murder trials. It was the next logical step. That there's something in me where I need the company of murderers about once a week. Because it really fascinates me. And I'm not saying I approve of murder or anything like that. It's the one thing I like to figure out why people do things. I mean, I've always been interested in abnormal psychology, all that kind of thing. And so I knew a person that taught there as a living, and he brought me in as a guest teacher a few times, and I showed my films. And I really wanted to get a job there. I thought it would be interesting, and it was, of course, irony to get a paycheck from the state of Maryland to rehabilitate people by showing them my films. I thought was rather strange. So I went to talk to the warden, who was a woman who was belied the big bird cage and that kind of female prison warden. And she was at first concerned I wanted to make like a documentary exposing the prison. I think this is a good prison. I mean, they're under psychiatric care. They have to keep up or they're put back in the bad prisons. So that's how it started. And I showed them all my films. My book, Shock Value, was required reading. I think it's the only college in the country that had my book as a textbook. And I got a lot out of it. And they got a lot out of it, I think. I don't think I was bad for them. I told them, look, everybody wants to murder somebody every once in a while, but don't do it. Draw it. Write a story about it. I said, these films are my crimes, only I get paid for it. And at first, they were kind of bewildered to hear that. But I don't think that's bad advice.
There's a lot of people who believe in a lot of sociologists who say that showing violent movies encourages people to be violent, and that showing movies about crime might encourage people to commit them.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, having worked with,
we talked about
prison,
that. You'd be surprised at the films they show in prison. I mean, they show sometimes hardcore pornography, which shocked me. We talked about that. We had a whole class about that. I don't think my films are what they mean because they're comedies, but we're talking about things like maybe the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or something like that. And some of them said that some of the people that were really violent psychopaths would watch them the same way someone would watch pornography, to be turned on by them. And that is a question there's no answer to. I agree. But if you then nobody can see those movies because one person reacts like that, I don't think that's fair either. I mean, he can get turned on by that from turning on television too. These people, some of them, when they saw the films, they acted just like my parents. They were very straight. They would say, why would you make a movie like that? But in the same way, I think they figured if I could make a living doing this on the streets, there was hope for all of them, I think, in the long run.
Whoever would have thought that your films would be used in a therapeutic, rehabilitative context?
Well, in a way, you think of it, the Pink Flamingos, that can freak out society's outlaws, where that humor was more dangerous to them than the hideous things they did with guns and everything, that they could freak out people that did that maybe isn't bad, because they realized that you could use something like that to be antisocial, but it's not going to hurt anybody.
Two of the people who you've worked with a lot are Divine, who's a really big man who plays the leading lady in all your movies, and the late Edie Massey.
Yeah.
Did it ever seem like the joke was on them, especially on Edie, who...
I know what...
And here's what I'm asking, that they're both really heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And in your movies would appear in really revealing clothes that would accentuate every fold in the flesh that would hang over their stomachs and thighs and rears. And you could interpret it as kind of making fun of their size.
I don't think I was. I really like people that society has branded as outsiders who turn what they're discriminated against into a militant style. And that's why the whole image of Divine came up. A person that is fat does not usually wear skin-tight cocktail dresses. With Edie, only in one movie was she dressed really like that, in Female Trouble, in her black leather suit. Edie, I think you could always tell in the films, I liked her. You know, and I did like Edie. I never thought I was making fun of Edie. I think Edie was a very gifted comedian in her own wacky kind of way. I don't think anybody could imitate her. I think she was like nobody else. She had a delivery that was like nobody else, and she had a voice like nobody else. Edith certainly was made to look grotesque sometimes, yes. But I think that you liked her still. I don't think that you were laughing at her. I hope not.
So you see it as different than, say, Fellini's use of grotesques in his movies?
I think Fellini loves his grotesques too, though. Have you seen this book, Fellini Faces? It's just all the people that have sent him resumes through the years, and it's unbelievable. I think he respects those people. I certainly do. I think that I don't want to look like that, I'll be honest. But, you know, Divine just lost 92 pounds. I'm so afraid he's going to end up real skinny, and we'll have to make the Karen Carpenter story. That'll be the only movie we can make.
Have you ever felt really alienated or like a grotesque? I mean, do you identify with people who were really on the fringe?
I respect those people. Yes, I'm fascinated by those people. And sometimes the things I'm fascinated with, I am attracted and repelled by at the same time.
I can understand that kind of feeling.
That you think, oh, my God. I mean, when I see some people on the street, I think, how could they walk around looking like that and not realize how grotesque they look? But at the same time, I sort of respect them for it obviously means very much to them to look like that.
John Waters recorded in 1985. His film Pink Flamingos has been re-released in celebration of its 25th anniversary. Coming up from the archives, an interview with the film's late star, Divine. This is Fresh Air.
It's Madison time. Hit it. You're looking good. A big, strong man. When I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back. with a big strong turn and back to the medicine.
Divine, the star of several John Waters films, was often referred to as a 300-pound drag queen, but he preferred to think of himself as a character actor. It was Waters' movie Pink Flamingos that first made Divine famous. His look was unforgettable, his huge frame covered in a skin-tight, low-cut gown. Divine's last film with Waters was Hairspray. I spoke with Divine in February of 1988 when Hairspray was released. 1 month later, Divine died of a heart attack. When we spoke, I gingerly asked Divine about the most talked-about moment in Pink Flamingos when Divine eats a real dog turd.
I'm just going to ask you one question about the famous Pink Flamingos scene in which the movie ends, and just one question about it, and then you have to eat a fresh dog turd. And you and John Waters have both said that you did it to kind of get attention, and the film really did. I mean, you were real upcoming people.
Well, John came to me and he said, well, you know, would you do this? I said, oh, sure. I thought he was kidding. And a year later, he said, okay, now tomorrow you have to eat the dog turd. I thought, oh, this is great. He wasn't kidding, you know. And he said, well, listen, do you want to be famous or do you want to be completely forgotten about? He said, it's going to do either one or the other for you. It's going to make you or forget. You said, your name will go down in movie history forever anyway, no matter what you do. And I thought, well, what do I care? You know, I was very young and you don't think about all these things. And I didn't really think about it until I had to follow that dog around for 3 hours. And finally it went. And it was quite a hideous experience, actually.
Well, here's my question. Did you rush off to an emergency room afterwards?
Well, no, I went home.
That's a silly question, but I'd be wondering about, you know, germs and things like
well,
that.
Well, I know. I had mouthwash and things. And, and I brushed my teeth and goggled. Anyway, I went home, and I was sitting there. And the more I thought about it, then I started to worry. So I called the hospital, and I'll never forget this. And I didn't know what to tell them, you know, because I was a bit older, running around eating dog feces. You know? So I called and I said, oh, hello, this is Mrs. Johnson, and my son just ate dog duty, and what should I do? And she said, well, how old is your son? And I said, well, he's, you know, 24 years old. And well, then the nurse got, she said, some maniac's on the phone here. Her son's 24 and he's eating dogs. So I got back on the phone. She said, well, why? And I had to tell her, well, I said that he was retarded and that we had a dog and he was in the backyard playing with the dog. The dog had gone to the bathroom and he'd eaten the dog mess, you know. So, she said, well, you just have to wash his mouth out and, you know, do all this. She said, but feel his stomach every day because he could get what was called the, you know, like a worm, a white worm. And every day I was feeling my stomach to see if it could. Finally, one day it got hard and I thought, oh, my God, I've got it. But I had hysterical white worms as it was. I didn't have anything. So I was very lucky. But she suggested that I get rid of the dog.
You know, John Waters has said that he really has always loved it when people who don't fit mainstream good looks take what they have and really turn it into style, turn it into, you know, an advantage. Did you feel like you were doing that when you were growing up? Because you were, I think you were always pretty heavy.
Yeah, well, no, actually not, because I was very much an introvert, and I never really went out of the house till I was about 16 years old. I was very uptight about my weight and about the way I looked, and always wanted to look like everyone else. And finally, my junior year, like when I was 16 and in high school, is when I really started hanging out with John and everyone else, that I got the confidence together to go out. And I was always in a coat. I always had a raincoat on or something. People probably thought I was a flasher, but I was just uptight about, you know, how fat I was. But at the same time, couldn't or wouldn't do anything about it. Finally, I went on a diet, like I said, my junior year, and lost to 80 pounds and went down to 145 and for my senior year. And then I was able to get dates and go to the prom and everything. But still, it was strange to me because all of a sudden people talked to me. They wouldn't talk to me when I was fat. And I thought, well, what's this all about? You know, it was a rude awakening, actually, at a very young age.
How did the tough guys in the school treat you, the people who really were the hoods?
Oh, well, I wasn't. They used to wait for me every day to beat me up after school. And I mean, to the point where I was quite black and blue and afraid to say anything because they had threatened my life. And it was very bad. And finally, one day, I had to go for a physical to the doctor. And when I disrobed. I mean, it was quite obvious that something terrible was happening to me. And finally, I broke down after a lot of questioning and told him what the problem was. And they called my parents, and when they saw what I looked like, they were quite hysterical. And we had the police at the school, and the kids were expelled. And it was quite an ugly situation, which made me even more unpopular with their friends and the other people, you know. But so I had to go through, like I said, the next 2 years of school with that stigma attached to me. But then I think finally, like I said, in my senior year, it was more or less all right. It wasn't so bad.
You said that it was John Waters who gave, you know, who helped give you your image.
Right.
How did you decide on what that image was going to be when you first were getting
it
together?
Well, at the time, there were Andy Warhol and a lot of people were making cult movies, and as they called them, underground films then, which were just the equivalent of your independently made movies today, low budget. And so the one name, like Viva, was very popular. So John gave me the name Divine. He just said he thought I was, and it was that I was funny and that I was divine, and it was a good name for me. And also because we had a very heavy Catholic upbringing, we had sort of religious names. So I don't know. Of course, the names became more popular again today with Madonna and Cher and Prince and Princess and all of these people. Yeah, so I think with John, wanted a very large woman because, as you had said before, he wanted the exact opposite of what normally would be beautiful. He wanted a 300-pound beauty as opposed to a 110-pound beauty. He wanted, as I've been called, an inflated Jane Mansfield. that's what he got. And also, it's ironic that he would say the most beautiful woman in the world turns out to be a man. So everything there is backwards. So it's really a John Waters character.
Divine, recorded in 1988. He died of a heart attack 1 month after we spoke. You can see Divine in the film Pink Flamingos, which has been re-released in celebration of its 25th anniversary. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Just a gigolo, and everywhere I go, people know the part I'm.
Actor Stanley Tucci got tired of playing the heavy, so he created the kind of character he wanted to portray. Coming up, he tells us about co-writing, co-directing, and starring in Big Night, which is now out on video. And John Powers reviews the new movie Kissed, which is about a taboo subject.
When the end comes, I know there's just a gigolo. Life goes on without me, and just a gigolo, everywhere I go, people know the part I'm playing, paid for every dance, selling each romance, oh, what they say, and there will come a day pass away. What will they say about me? When the end comes, I know there's just a gigolo. Life goes on without me, 'cause I ain't got nobody. Oh, and there's nobody to kiss for me. There's nobody to kiss for me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After always getting cast as the heavy, Stanley Tucci changed his image with his recent film Big Night, which has just come out on video. He co-wrote, co-directed, and co-starred in the film. Now you can also see him in the film comedy Day Trippers. Tucci played heavies in such films as Kiss of Death, The Pelican Brief, and Billy Bathgate. The TV series Wise Guy helped launch his career and show off what an effective bad guy he could be. More recently, the TV series Murder One widened his following. He starred as the accused murderer, Richard Cross. Last year, I asked Stanley Tucci what he wanted to do in Big Night that he wasn't able to do in his previous roles.
I wanted to carry a picture, meaning, you know, play the guy who we follow from beginning to end. I wanted also to try to create an ambiguous leading man, a man who was not incredibly heroic. And so often in films, I think particularly American films, we see the leading man is always some sort of hero, and he is without a lot of faults. And I wanted this character to be very human and to see if the audience would indeed care about him.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you tired of playing the heavy in movies also?
I'm so tired of it, I can't tell you.
It's too bad. You know, I really like you as the heavy. Does that bother you to hear me say that?
No, it doesn't. No, I'm very flattered. And I really, listen, I have no problem playing the heavy if it is an interestingly written role. If there's a complexity to it, if there's a humanity to the role.
Mm-hmm.
What I do have difficulty with is that so often I'm asked to play the heavy only because I'm Italian. And I think that happens very often to a lot of Italian American actors. It's the prevailing view of the Italian American in Hollywood is a pretty bleak one, and it's something that won't go away. It's been around since really film began, and that's what I'm tired of. That's what I'm tired of most of all. If I can have a varied career, and I've been very lucky. I mean, I've done a lot of different things, but. But inevitably, there's always that mafia stuff that keeps cropping up. And one of the reasons we made this picture is to change that.
Now, it's funny. I mean, the two things that Italians are associated with most in movies mm-hmm. are organized crime and mm-hmm. pasta, right?
Right.
So you're rejecting the organized crime thing, but you are kind of heading in the pasta direction, if you know what I mean. It's a film very
right.
much about food and a certain right. kind of Italian obsession with the preparation of food.
Right. Yeah, it is. Although we do use risotto at the beginning.
Yes, that's right. And yeah. the clientele is very angry because it's not a big portion, and they even ask for pasta on the
right,
side.
Exactly. You know, we're not giving them pasta, only if it's appropriate. And that's sort of the point of the film is it's fine, and we love pasta, and I love pasta. I go through withdrawal if I don't have it every couple of days. But let's have it when it's appropriate. And so what we're saying is let's have those images of Italians. Let's bring those things into play when they are organic to the story. Let's not impose them on the film or the characters.
While you were writing and then shooting the film, did you go to a lot of restaurants to get get a sense of the atmosphere in different restaurants and the people there and just pick
oh,
up
yeah.
on little things?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For years and years and years, it went on. I ended up peeking at Le Madre in New York, which is this great restaurant on 17th Street. And I met a guy named Johnny Scapin, who has since become a friend. He's the head chef there. And I worked with him for like a year and a half, on and off, in the kitchen. And he taught me a great deal. But before that, I had gone to all different kinds of restaurants, and I would always make notes and talk to people, torture the owner, or, you know, the waiter, or whomever, asking endless questions. And it was fascinating, I have to say. It was so fascinating. And it let me know that we were on the right track when we were writing.
In the movie, you're not the chef. I mean, you're the you're the business oriented brother.
Mm-hmm.
But there are times when you're in the kitchen slicing vegetables or, you know, whipping up eggs, and you slice and whip with the confidence of somebody who really knows how to cook, who's very familiar with the kitchen. Is this something that you learned from understudying the chef?
Yes, yeah, I did. I mean, I have always cooked. I mean, I grew up in a family that is food obsessed. So, you know, I was always cooking and learned how to cook. But I really learned from this guy a great deal, you know, how to chop. You know, it was, you know, I'd go in and start chopping an onion at first, and it was really humiliating. you know, he was a nervous wreck that I was going to cut my fingers off. But he taught me a great deal, to be comfortable around that space. And I had to be comfortable around that space as an actor, but also as a director. I had to be able to tell people what to do and where I put the camera and so on and so forth. So it was very important that I knew as much as possible.
What was your food like at home when you were growing up?
Great. Just incredible. In fact, I'm trying to put together like a cookbook now with my mother and Johnny, because I really want her recipes and the recipes of my family to be known, because it was just such a great way to grow up. The food was incredible. My mother became an incredibly sophisticated cook over the years. And, you know, I'd bring these enormous lunches to school, these sort of gourmet meals, you know, and everybody else had
peanut butter and jelly. What would you take to school? I had tuna fish on white bread a lot. What did you have?
No, I never had that. No, I had tuna fish, but it was usually on a nice Italian bread, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, all different things. You'd bring a veal cutlet sandwich or an eggplant sandwich or, God knows what, you know, so much stuff. And I was very thin and small, but I ate for 10 men. So I would bring my lunch in a, you know, when you go to the grocery store and you get like a regular bag for your groceries? That's what I brought my lunch in, because like the little lunch bags were too small to fit all the food I had. So maybe it's disgusting, but I ate like a king.
Now, there's an entire scene in your movie toward the end that's, uh-huh. What's happening in the scene, I mean, there's an emotional subtext, of course, but what you actually see in the scene is your character breaking eggs, beating the eggs, putting the eggs and oil into the frying pan, uh-huh. flipping the eggs, putting them on the plate, eating them. This all happens in real time.
Right.
And I thought that was actually kind of brave, you know, to spend that much time following your character making these eggs. And again, there's a lot of emotional stuff happening beneath the surface, but there's no dialogue during the scene. There's no music. It's just completely mm-hmm. quiet. Tell me about that scene.
Well, it seemed, in a way, it was an experiment, I guess. It seemed, first of all, the best way to get across what we wanted to get across. After the brothers have this huge scene on the beach, what were they going to say? And you know, so many things run through your head. And my cousin and I, as I said, we wrote this together, and you think, well, this could happen, that could happen, this could happen. What could they say? And we realized nothing. Best if they say nothing. So, but what was very important to me was after the cacophony that goes on during the party sequence and the fight on the beach and the stimuli that's sort of coming at the audience and that the characters in the film are getting, we need to go back to square one, and we need to see the effects on these people of this night that they've put together. And the best way to do it was to just show them going about the most simple act and cooking the most simple thing. And also to have my character cook, because he's not the cook, and to have him cook eggs seemed to be appropriate. It's a beginning to me.
Did you have anybody tell you this scene goes on too long? You should just like do some inner cutting so you don't have to watch the eggs from beginning to end.
Oh sure, yeah, but I didn't listen to him because I knew it worked, and I knew it would work. And even when we had the when we showed people the script, you know, they'd see the script and they'd say, "Well, this is great, but you know, where's the ending?" And you say, "Well, that is the ending." I say, "Well, yeah, but you know, what does that mean?" So, "I don't know what it means." You know, I just, but there's no dialogue, there's no this. And I say, "Well, it will work. I know it'll work, and you have to trust me as an actor. I know the kind of information that I can get across, and somebody like Tony, who's so good, and Mark Anthony, that we can get across just with our bodies. And by the end of the film, the audience should know." Should know the character so well that they should be almost like a family member or like a lover. So they should know that when I walk into a room or Tony walks into a room, if our head is turned a certain way, if our body is like this, they know what we're feeling. And you should be able to watch that. If you care about them, you should be able to watch it really forever, I think, like you watch somebody that you care about, like you can watch someone you care about forever. So, yeah, people did say, you know, don't, maybe this, maybe you could put the credits over that or something horrible, you know. And I'd say, no, but it's okay. And it's very interesting in the theaters. I mean, we took a big chance. I mean, but it's very interesting in the theaters. You can hear a pin drop. And I'm so thankful because I didn't do any coverage, you know.
tell what coverage means.
Coverage meaning that I didn't go in for any close-ups. I didn't shoot Mark Anthony from another angle and then shoot me and then shoot Tony entering and all that stuff. It's one take, and that's all there is to it. And either it was going to work or it wasn't going to work. And if it didn't work, then I was really screwed.
My guest is Stanley Tucci. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stanley Tucci. He co-directed, co-wrote, and co-starred in Big Night, which has just come out on video. And now he's co-starring in the film comedy Day Trippers. Back to our interview, recorded last year. Now, you had to think of editing and pacing in this movie mm-hmm. in the way that you've never had to before, because, you know, in the past you've just been acting your role and you don't have to worry about the larger film process. What did you do to get a sense of editing and pacing? I mean, did you go back and study certain films that you particularly love?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Over and over and over again.
Which were the films you looked at over and over?
Well, there's a handful of them that I kept going back to. And I'd sort of try to look at other films, and then I'd just keep going back to these movies. La Dolce Vita was one. 8 and a Half was another. A Sunday in the Country by Tavernier is one. Rules of the Game. Raging Bull. Films like that.
What doesn't fit in this picture category? Raging Bull. I mean, there's some scenes, like the boxing scenes, that are so mm-hmm. quickly cut.
Right.
And that's really different from the pace of your film or from the other films that you've mentioned.
Yeah, it is. But also, if you look at the dialogue scenes, I mean, the lengthy dialogue scenes,
true.
They're so beautifully shot.
True. Right.
A lot of masters, and the coverage is very simple and straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Manhattan was another film, in fact, that I would go to because of almost the entire film is master shots. It's so beautifully constructed, and the pacing is so beautiful.
You said that one of the reasons why you wanted to direct is that you were tired of directors who didn't know how to talk to actors.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the typical problems you've faced when communicating with directors?
Well, I think that a lot of directors will come from a technical background, and that's fine for certain aspects of the film, but there's a huge aspect that, you know, we're leaving out, which is the actors and how they move within the space and how they communicate with each other and how they get your point across. I think the struggle that we all found, and, you know, Campbell felt the same thing, Steve Buscemi, who just directed his own film, I know feels the same way, is that they deal with actors, they speak very generally, and they'll use words like, you know, your attitude in this scene, or I don't even know what else. I mean, because the language is so nebulous. But they really don't understand, most of all, what they don't understand is physicality. And that's why I think you see a lot of coverage, because they only can concentrate on the faces and the words as opposed to the actor's physicality and the space that surrounds the actor and the space that exists in between the actors physically. That is just as important as the close-up to me and the words that are being spoken. And that was something in this film that we wanted to try to make use of. And it's really, I guess, like an older style of filmmaking. But we trust actors, or we love actors.
Why don't you explain the expressions coverage and master shots?
Okay. Master shot is usually a wide shot, meaning you put a wide-angle lens on and you can see all of the action that's happening in the room, and you play the scene from beginning to end. Coverage would be then going in for specific moments, going in with tighter lenses. You would go in and do something like a medium shot, which would be, let's say, from the waist up, and then you would go into a close-up. And you usually go into the close-up on the more poignant moment of the scene, the medium shot for the middle of the scene, and the master shot for the opening of the scene. That's a standard sort of formula.
Now, as an actor, what are some of the things that you like and don't like about the close-up versus the master shot?
What I don't like about the close-up is I feel that it's really overused. I feel that what it does is it gives everything the same weight if it is overused. If you're going to use it, it must be used sparingly. As much as I love people's faces, I love their bodies equally as much, and a person's hand or their foot can tell as much as their eyes, I think. So I like to be able to see the whole picture when the whole picture should be seen. I don't think everything should be in a master shot.
Now, a lot of our listeners know you from the role of Richard Cross, the billionaire murder suspect in Murder One.
Right.
How did you get that part?
Well, it all happened at the same time we got the money for the movie, so it was a very sort of hectic time. I auditioned for another part. I auditioned for the part that Dylan Baker played in the series. And they said, why don't you try reading this other part? It was written for like a 60-year-old man, and I thought, thanks a lot. I mean, I've lost my hair, but I mean, come on. So I read it, and they wanted me to play it, and they adapted the role for me. They made him a little younger, thank God. And so I actually turned it down first because I was afraid that I couldn't do both things. But the schedule worked out just fine. The guys at Reicher, who produced our movie, gave the okay that I could be shooting the film during the pilot during a small portion of our pre-production period, and then I would edit the film in L.A. I would shoot the series in L.A. and I'd edit the film in New York, and that was sort of a nightmare. But that's how it all came about. And Stephen Bochco was just, and the people there were extraordinary. I mean, they really helped work around my schedule, which wasn't easy.
Now, this one trial lasted all season, and viewers didn't find out if you did it or not until the very end. When did you find out?
Well, I had to lie to the press for a long time and say that I didn't know what was happening. But I did know after, the third episode or something, because I was very frustrated. I went to them and I said, look, this is very hard for me to do. I don't know what the hell is going on. How am I supposed to act this? You know, besides I have jet lag all the time, you know, what can I do here? And Stephen called me in and said, look, this is basically what's going to happen, I think. And I said, okay, that helps me. And then I lied to everyone, including the cast members.
Wow.
But I found out later that they all had been told things. But I still didn't really believe them when they told me. I thought they were making it up just to make me feel better because he really wanted to keep it a secret. And I don't blame him. You know, he's got a lot riding on it.
So the acting problem that the secrecy posed for you is that you didn't know if you were guilty or innocent, you didn't know whether you were covering up or telling the truth.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, to me it was that, but it was even more than that. I needed to know a little bit more about the character and the relationships between everyone, and they weren't really giving that out. So that was really important to me. To me it was also if you're guilty, you're going to act like you're innocent. And if you're innocent, you're going to act like you're innocent. So it doesn't really make a difference if you know or not. in a way. So it was really more the relationships.
But the difference is, if you're innocent, you'll just be innocent, whereas if you're guilty, you will act innocent. There'll be a certain amount of acting involved, right?
No, no, no. You have to be innocent. You can't act innocent. You have to be innocent.
No, 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 no. No, but I mean, the real person would be acting innocent. And wouldn't you want to pick up on the fact that they're being a little phony there, that they're acting innocent as opposed to just being innocent?
No,
no,
no, because then it gives it away.
Uh-huh.
Then you give it away, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if I'm guilty and I give away to the audience that I'm acting innocent, well, then the show's over.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to completely be innocent, whether I know that I'm... I mean, I did find out that I wasn't guilty, of course, so, you know. But even when I didn't know I was guilty, I was assuming that I was going to be the guy for a while, you know. I just pretended I was completely innocent.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Stanley Tucci recorded last year when his film Big Night was released. It just came out on home video. Tucci is now featured in the film comedy Day Trippers. Well, here's Louis Prima, who is an off-screen character in Big Night.
Buonasera, signorina, buonasera. It is time to say goodnight to Napoli. Though it's hard for us to whisper buonasera with that old moon above the Mediterranean Sea. In the morning, signorina, we'll go walking where the mountains help the sun come into sight. And by the little jewelry shop we'll stop and linger while I buy a wedding ring for your finger.
In the meantime, let me tell you that I love you.
Buonasera, signorina, kiss me goodnight. Buonasera, signorina, kiss me goodnight. But red do that to the pot, bona bani boat, but do the bath of the boat. Buonasera, signorina, buonasera. It is time to say goodnight to Napoli. Though it's hard for us to whisper buonasera with that old moon above the Mediterranean Sea. In the morning, signorina, we'll go walking where the mountains of the sun come into sight. And by the little jewelry shop we'll stop and linger while I buy a wedding ring for your finger.
Coming up, a new film on a taboo subject. This is Fresh Air. Kissed is a new feature film from Canada that takes on one of the few remaining taboo sexual obsessions. It's based on the short story We So Seldom Look on Love by Barbara Gowdy. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
By now, movie sex scenes are such old hat that I feel I've seen people making love everywhere. On beaches, in elevators, atop automobiles, sometimes even in bed. But there's never been a sex scene quite like the one in Kissed. The film's heroine sneaks into a funeral parlor, peels off her blouse, climbs onto the mortician's table, and makes love to a corpse. Yes, Kissed is a film about necrophilia. It's the story of Sandra, a young woman who finds such magical energy in death that she claims she's seen cadavers shining like stars. We watch Sandra's obsession sprout during girlhood, when she stages elaborate burials for dead animals, and it blooms during puberty, when her rituals take on a new erotic charge. She gets aroused while dissecting a mouse in biology class. Eventually, she takes a job at a funeral home while studying embalming at college. There, she gets involved with Matt, a medical student who becomes obsessed with Sandra and her obsessions. But while Sandra is content to be Matt's lover, what really turns her on is making love with dead bodies, invariably young and male. That way, she jokes, I'm straight. And in fact, Sandra seems more normal than you might expect. This is partly because of actress Molly Parker, whose freckled, innocent, girl-next-door beauty is the perfect counterweight to Sandra's inner perversity. Parker is smart enough to realize that Sandra's desires may seem outrageous to the audience, but they're not outrageous to her. Parker knows that any broadness in her performance will plunge the whole movie straight into camp, so she's matter-of-fact, almost deadpan, as when she first meets Matt at a cafe.
Primary postmortem.
Yep.
Why?
I like the pictures.
Well, there's a newer edition out in the bookstore. That higher resolution photographs. Are you a pathology student? I've never seen you around before.
I work in a funeral home. I'm studying embalming.
Really? You know, that's really the only way to know a corpse. Don't you think?
I don't know.
Sure you do. I mean, you see it all.
We're living through days when artists have upped the sexual ante so high that something like the missionary position seems almost quaint. We're being inundated by weird sex, from overhyped novels about incest to porn stars sleeping with hundreds of men at a go, then coming on TV to boast. There's no denying that Kiss is part of this trend, nor is it accidental that the year's two kinkiest movies, this one and Crash, are both Canadian. Canada is a culture whose veneer of bland repression masks and inflames a tendency toward underlying psychic chaos. It's a whole country that resembles Twin Peaks. Yet what's compelling about Kissed isn't really its outlandish subject matter. It's the artistry of first-time director Lynn Stopkovich, whose visual flair and control of offbeat tone made me think of the young Jane Campion. She's able to be simultaneously funny and poetic. Which isn't to say that the movie's perfect. Actor Peter Outerbridge is a bit washed out as Matt, and the story rushes to its predictably ironic conclusion. For once, I think a movie's too short. You see, Kissed is filled with great stuff. The best scenes take place at the funeral home. Not only does Stopkovich carefully show us how a mortuary works, she tells us what we want to know, but she depicts Sandra's co-workers with the slyness you find in the films of Buñuel. Turns out Sandra isn't the only one with a thing for corpses. Yet even as the movie has fun with its morbidity, it gives Sandra's attraction to the dead a genuinely spiritual aura. In the scene when she makes love to the corpse on the table, the camera circles and soars, Parker's face takes on a look of radiant bliss, and we believe in the exaltation she's feeling. In such transcendent moments, Kissed achieves something genuinely extraordinary. It takes a passion so freaky that it makes your flesh crawl, and makes it seem almost normal.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.